This podcast is exclusively sponsored by Equiland, a global fintech firm for the securities finance industry.
This is Matt MacArthur, and we are back with our first episode of Asia Securities Finance Monthly for 2024. Admittedly, it has been a long 5 months since our last podcast, but I promise to make it up to you, not only with better content, but with more A-list securities finance guests. And today, we have with us one of my all-time market favorites. So if there is ever an episode to lean back and buckle up, this is the one. Coming up on Asia Securities Finance Monthly.
Global elections, you know, they're going to be so prominent in shaping, I think, 2024.
We sit down with Karen King of S&P Global Market Intelligence to discuss market trends, recruitment, and mental health. And when I think of a liquidity provider, I think of trading pits, colorful jackets, hand signals, like the Chicago Board of Exchange in the 90s.
Certainly, 37 years ago, that's very much where we were. Very colorful trading jackets.
We take a closer look at the world of liquidity providers with Stefan Martin from Optiva. It is my pleasure to have with us today Karen King from S&P Global Market Intelligence. Welcome, KK.
Hi, Matt.
Now, Karen, you have done it all. London, Hong Kong, Singapore for a very hot minute, now back to Hong Kong. You sat on the trading desk at Goldman Sachs for years, then ran sales, then managing director of business development, and now solutions architect. With a resume like that, you might as well run against Donald Trump for president. Hell, I'd vote for you.
Thanks, Matt.
Okay, let's get down to business. The recent PASLA conference in Singapore back in March, another huge crowd. Can you give us a general overview of the conference?
Because I thought Japan last year really topped it off because we had so many people attending. This year, it was, you know, equally as busy. There was a huge range of topics that panels went through. I wasn't actually able to attend all of them, but it was good to hear again that the Philippines is going to be opening up to lending and that Indonesia is thinking and following suit. I, of course, enjoyed moderating the market access panel where you're able to go through such a diverse conversation based off obviously all the fragmented markets that we have in Asia. And of course, the buy side panel was incredibly popular considering the activities that, you know, on the buy side tend to drive a lot of the trading that we have in the SBL market.
Now, for those who have never been to PASLA, who attends, what's discussed, and more importantly, why is it helpful?
Do you know what, Matt? What I absolutely love about PASLA is the continuing diversity of the desks and teams that attend. If I think, you know, originally it was purely stock loan desks. It then grew to include collateral and tri-party teams. Beneficial owners then started to attend. We always get a handful of buy-side firms. And now more recently, we're seeing a lot of repo desks too, which typically opens up the content and the discussions that we're able to have. I'm slightly embarrassed to admit that I've been attending PASLA for over 20 years now, and it's such a great conference from both an educational point of view and also for networking, building deeper relationships and thought leadership. I may leave, I think, every year a little bit more broken than the last one, but I do generally, you know, look forward to it every year because I think it's a very, very valuable conference that we have annually.
Now, I've never been to the RMA in the US or ISLA in Europe. What's the difference between those and the annual conference here, PASLA?
So I've attended two RMA events and a handful of the ISLA ones, but both were quite some time ago. In many ways, I think the content and the setup are quite similar, although the ones in the US managed to hold a lot more sporting events and outdoor activities alongside the conference. And I think we may need to up our game in 2025 with either a golf or a tennis tournament alongside the conference. But I would say, you know, one of the key differences with PASLA is that it tends to be truly global in its attendance, as many of the US and the European heads come over for PASLA, whereas RMA and ISLA typically have less attendance from Asia, so it tends to be more US and European focus. So I think we tend to, in many ways, have a bit more of a rounded conference when it comes to attendance.
All right, so if you book Tiger Woods next year, can you put me in his foursome?
Well, you want, Tiger Woods isn't playing so well right now.
Yeah, well, he won't be getting any tips from me, that's for sure. Now, I have to warn you, there is some assembly required with this next question. What attracts talent to the finance world? With artificial intelligence growing by the day with the likes of Apple and Google and Meta, is finance even attractive anymore?
I think a lot of thought has to go into attracting talent going forward within the finance industry because we really are dealing with a very different generation. it's no longer just about competitive compensation. You know, we have to be thoughtful around work-life balance, company culture, social responsibility, technical education and implementation. We can't really be seen to be the sort of the dinosaurs in the market. It just won't attract the younger generation at all. And I think firms who innovate and are prepared to truly adapt and change will benefit the most. And I think those that don't will definitely be left behind when it comes to attracting some of the top talent.
You know, you make a great point. I know here with our inbound talent this year, we're going to have a rotational program for the first time in a long time, which is great. Now let's peel back the work onion a bit. The hedge fund environment in Asia, is it growing again? And if so, what themes are they seeing?
Do you know what? It's for the first time in quite a few years, it's so exciting to see so many new fund launches coming into the market in Asia, because it really has been quite quiet for the last 18 months to 2 years. I think what we're seeing is a huge growth in the platforms in Asia. You know, the existing ones that everyone knows, your Millenniums, Balyasny's, Citadel, Exodus Point, Schonfelds, they're all getting bigger, and a lot of that growth is actually coming into Asia, with most of them splitting their teams between Hong Kong and Singapore, which is quite refreshing. So it's not all in one place. It's kind of split between the both. We're also seeing some new platforms coming out as well, which is they've got sort of a bit more of a niche setup. And we continue to see growth in Chinese quants, both onshore and offshore, and quite a few multi-strat launches. So from a new launch perspective, I think this year's got a great pipeline, more in the second half, but there are some good ones that have come out already. And then from, I suppose, an investment perspective, some of the key themes we're seeing is a higher demand for textual data as companies become more sophisticated at ingesting it. We're seeing a lot of demand in supply chain information off the back of all of the global disruption. There's definitely more interest in cross-asset signals. So we're seeing a big growth in credit strategies, and those firms are looking, sort of seeing more fluidity from sort of through asset classes off the back of all the interest rate environment. So people are looking to see what signals they can get from the fixed income market going into the equity markets. That's actually been a huge theme for us this year. And a general increase in factor investment, either single factor or multi-factor investment, mostly multi-factor. And of course, short interest data. It just continues to be, you know, a key point of sentiment analysis that we see constant demand for.
You know, you nailed it, KK. My holy grail is to get one of the funds on board, but it's so difficult, but we'll keep trying. Now, 2024 already seems like a hurry up and wait environment. Will the Fed move interest rates again? Will inflation ever come down? The pending U.S. elections. What do you think will define 2024?
You know, interest rates, it just comes up. I get the Bloomberg emails every day. I mean, they're on every single one. But I think for me, there's probably sort of three key areas. I think one is global elections. You know, they're going to be so prominent in shaping, I think, 2024. I think it's something like there's over 60 countries scheduled to hold elections this year. And some key ones have happened. So Taiwan and Russia, India. But the ones that everybody's really eyes are on are obviously UK, US and European Parliament. And I think these elections have such potential for massive shifts in their political parties. So I think that's going to be one key influence. Another one is war at the end of the day, armed conflict. It's causing quite a bit of influence into many things. I think we're going to see extended volatility in commodity and energy prices and supply chain disruptions. So I think there's going to be a lot of lies on that in 24. And then finally, slightly different one actually is resource security. So for example, securing the supply of critical minerals and elements, for example, for new technologies and energy. And we already saw that last week with the US and Japan announcing putting measures in place for chip development. There's a lot of chat about the Lobito Corridor in Africa, you know, around elements or minerals in that space. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on this year, and we've actually got a really interesting piece on it that S&P Global put out on their news and research. But those three, I think, are big things we're going to continue to hear about for the rest of 24.
Now let's troubleshoot this. Is there any proof of life that the current slowdown in M&A and IPO activity will ever come back to normal?
I don't think we're going to see it skyrocket back anytime soon. I do think that we will see some pickup, and I don't think it really can get any worse than it was last year. You know, M&A and IPO activity, it does well when you've got good economic conditions, we've got strong markets, favorable interest rate environments. And, you know, on the downside at the moment, I'd say economic conditions aren't great, and they are exacerbated by sort of all the wartime situations we're seeing. There's also been some change in the US with a lot of antitrust concerns from regulators, which has created some barriers to some of the activity. But then on a positive note, you know, we're seeing a resurgence in the markets, you know, a bit more recently, and indications of interest rates to come down again. So there's some positive and some negative. From what I've seen, from there are some several subsectors where people are saying that there could be an increase in IPO activity, which is in the tech space, especially if they're going to create sort of increase in sort of efficiency within the markets. But ultimately, it really comes down to confidence. And I think as long as we continue to see sort of geopolitical tensions and escalations in the Middle East, I think it's gonna take a while for that to properly pick up again.
Now let's throw a big stone into this pond, see if we can get a ripple or two. Mental health. Sometimes we all feel like Hans Gruber from Die Hard, just hanging on the ledge by our fingernails, just waiting to fall. How can our industry, banking that is, do a better job of monitoring any potential health issues, mental health issues that is?
You know, this is actually so topical. It's quite a few people, you know, in the industry that we've lost to mental health. And I think it's such an important topic, and you can't ignore it. And it's really, really important for firms to actually concentrate on it and think how they can be doing it better. And I think there are a lot of things you can be doing. You can encourage open communication, ensure employees have an avenue to go to that's not just their manager. Provide managers training, right? You know, just because somebody comes to you and they're struggling doesn't mean as a manager are equipped to deal with it, especially, you know, with mental health issues. So I think, you know, training for managers is important, and firms really need to make sure they've got medical coverage to, you know, equip people with some of the tools that they need and some of the help that they've got. And one of my big ones is work-life balance, right? You can't function properly if you don't have your outs on the other side. So whether it's making sure people can exercise appropriately, taking adequate holiday, you know, not feeling they have to be in the office 24/7. And I think, you know, having firms setting up processes so that people actually can get some work-life balance, I think is incredibly important. But you know what, at the end of the day, it also comes down to looking out for your colleagues, because it can't all just be reliant on management and companies to put things in place. If you see somebody that's not in a great place, you know, it's up to you as one of their colleagues as to, you know, to get them out for a coffee, find out what's going on. I think it's just really important that everybody, you know, looks out for each other. So I think, you know, there's the things that companies can be doing, but as individuals, there's a lot of things as work colleagues we can be doing for each other as well.
You know, you nailed it. I don't exactly have the secret sauce to better mental health. And God knows if I did, I'd sell it. But maybe, as you mentioned, an easy blueprint to reduce stress levels is to never shy away from asking for help. Lean on people. I bet coworkers' natural reaction would be supportive, and they'd probably look forward to helping. At least that's the culture that I work in, and I just hope that applies to everybody listening. Karen, it is always a treat to catch up with a market legend. Thanks, KK. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Matt. It was a pleasure, and it's always fun chatting with you.
I'll be honest, as a judge, our next guest takes me completely out of my comfort zone. So I might give the impression that I'm stumbling around like a baby Dalmatian on ice, but hopefully I'll back into a good question or two. We have with us today, Stefan Martin from Singapore, head of derivatives institutional sales at Optiva. Welcome to the podcast, Stefan.
Delighted to be here. Thanks so much for your time and for having me on.
First off, walk us through your background at Optiva. And more importantly, what is a liquidity provider?
Optiva's got a really rich history of being in the markets. The firm is 37 years old. It was founded on the Amsterdam trading floors. And effectively, we've tracked the evolution of trading from local markets on floors in trading pits into the screens, and more recently into the off-screen block market space. And that's really where my business comes into play. So Optiva's institutional sales and trading teams are effectively responsible for all of our off-market, off-screen block trading with direct counterparties. And we're really proud to be working with some of the world's leading hedge fund managers, asset managers, and other institutional participants, effectively providing them in block market liquidity at all times, in all market conditions, in major asset classes listed on major exchanges across the world. I guess my story is slightly different. I started in the city of London. I've been in Asia for 10 years and with Optiva now for 5.5. And started in Hong Kong with the firm and most recently now here in Singapore.
Now, when I think of a liquidity provider, I think of trading pits, colorful jackets, hand signals, like the Chicago Board of Exchange in the 90s. What I'm trying to say is, can you explain the electronification of a liquidity provider? Basically, where were you 20 years ago and where are you today?
Yeah, sure. So maybe not 20 years ago, but certainly 37 years ago, that's very much where we were. Very colorful trading jackets. Our color was orange and we were present on, you know, major trading floors across the world. Our mission has never changed. Our mission is to improve the market, whether that was, you know, in our original days on those trading floors or more recently in this more technically advanced age. The big difference really, Matt, is technology. And now we're using and leveraging technology in such a way, whether that's through our ability to provide tight and consistent pricing in all market conditions, effective risk management, minimizing market impact. Effectively, by being at the forefront of the technology and having systems that are built to ensure speedy response times and stability, it effectively enables us to perform our task and our mission in the most efficient and effective way possible. So technology has been the game changer, and I think we are at the forefront of that change.
Now, I'm going to assume that you enjoyed being on the hot seat at the hedge fund and investor panel, but what were the themes at this year's PASLA, and did anything surprise you?
Yeah, it was a great privilege to have been invited to participate on the hedge fund and investor panel at PASLA this year in Singapore on home turf. I think what was really exciting for someone who is based in Asia was that Asia was once again at the forefront of a lot of the conversations. Obviously, we've all seen the equity rally in Japan, but also there have been some really interesting pockets of activity in Korea, a lot of discussions around the short selling bans there. We've had movement in Hong Kong, false rallies in China. So I think for a long period of my time here in Asia, going to these events, speaking with our counterparties, there's been, you know, increasingly a focus on US markets. The big difference this year was that a lot of people wanted to talk about Asia. Asia thematically very interesting and with probably a very interesting year ahead as well.
Now, I guess the follow-up question to that is, any opportunities that Optiva is looking at in the securities finance world?
So I think we play a relatively unique role, and firms like ours do as well, where we are a consumer of securities financing and SBL services from banks. So I suppose we compete with banks in some areas in terms of liquidity provision to end users, but we are also a consumer of their services. Where we need to be very diligent and ensure we've got excellent access to borrow, excellent processes, seamless post-trade is in that space, because SPL specifically supports our ETF and stock options market making activities. So we really want to be at the forefront of those conversations and continuing to, you know, contribute our voice to the industry as well.
Now, this question is a little bit of a Jedi mind trick, but living in the newer age of volatility, GameStop being a perfect recent example, with access to market information and the advent of retail trading and the use of volatile products like options, do you feel like this has been good for the market and liquidity, or are we just supercharged out of control?
My personal opinion is that increased retail participation is net positive for liquidity. It puts a lot of onus on liquidity providers like ourselves in ensuring that we're providing tight, consistent markets, ensuring that investors, whether they're retail or institutional, are always trading on best price. And I think we've seen effectively retail interest in options and derivatives more broadly, you know, at recent highs, whether that's in the US markets, some of those names that you mentioned there, GameStop and, you know, the advent, I guess, of zero DTE options on the S&P and other indices in the US, but also, you know, in the region, you know, if you look at the volumes on the Indian exchange or the Korea exchange, which have very high, healthy retail contribution, it's super interesting to see such enthusiasm for derivatives products. I think to answer your question and put it into a little bit of historical context, you know, we are seeing volumes at highs, but realized and implied volatilities at recent lows. So I think something that we're mindful of and the market is mindful of is, you know, what happens in the event that we do have a meaningful drawdown, let's say in the S&P 500. We've certainly not seen a greater than 2% move, at least since the early part of last year. And what would happen then if implied volatilities jumped up from around, you know, 15, 16 levels that they are today to the mid-20s, the 30s? You know, are we at risk of potentially seeing a systemic event like the ones that we saw in February 2018? So I think as a observer and a participant in those markets, something that we're very keen is to ensure that, you know, our role is to provide plentiful liquidity, even if markets do get volatile, so that markets remain healthy, functioning, and stable. And that's really the role that we'll play should markets get a little bit more spicy.
Now, if we talk about movies, I can easily turn into Rain Man, but I'm well out of my depth on market makers. So help me out here. What are some of the common misconceptions about market makers?
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic and one that we're really keen to speak to, because I think if you think of HFT firms and market makers, perhaps there is this myth or this misnomers that it's a speed game, that we go home flat every day, that we don't run any intraday risk, and that all we're interested in doing is potentially arbitraging our counterparties. A big part of my job is explaining to our counterparties and people like yourselves that that is absolutely not the case. You know, firms like Optiva do have a risk appetite and have a high tolerance for risk. We're backed by a substantial balance sheet, and all prices that we trade, all prices that we show, they're made, you know, off our own book using our own models. So I think any misconceptions that market makers are risk averse or not risk tolerant, I should say, that couldn't be further from the truth. Thanks to, you know, our technology, deep pools of internal liquidity, our trading strategies, firms like ours have really stepped into perhaps the gap that has been left by the banks, who are no longer able to be as active in a market making sense as they once were. I think a great example of this is in our options products. So we're trading all listed strikes, all listed expiries, which means in Europe, we're pricing options all the way up to 10 years. You know, you can't get out of a 10-year option in a day. So I think that's just a really great example where, you know, we do have superb risk tolerance, risk management, and a healthy appetite to, you know, to positively contribute to the market, whether that's in the very short-dated options expiries or all the way out to the rest of the curve.
One last question for you. Given the technology focus of someone like Optiva, what goes through your temples when we talk about talent, specifically talent development and any new ways to hire or even source talent?
Yeah, that's such a topical question. And, you know, it's never been more competitive for talent, I would say, than it is now. And I'm not just talking with regards to our own peers within the market making liquidity provision community, but also hedge funds, tech startups. It's incredibly competitive out there. So we invest a lot of time, effort, and resourcing into ensuring that we're incredibly visible, both in terms of campus activities, but also experienced hires. And, you know, never have had to be more visible to those two respective markets than we have now. But we do everything that we can to dedicate time and investment into the people that join this firm. And we give them great exposure to rotating between desks and products and regions, and really offering a high degree of variety into the jobs as well. And investing a lot of time and effort in really trying to make the connection between what people are working on from a theoretical aspect and how that has an impact practically as well. So I think putting that theory into practice, you know, whether that's through creating your own trading algorithms or models or participating in unique simulation style exercises, it's a really invigorating and fascinating program for anyone who's looking you know, at the HFT market making space.
Stefan, I do appreciate your patience as well as your time today. Exploring new avenues of finance is exactly what this podcast is about. Thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks, Mark.
As always, we appreciate you, the listener, and we hope in the coming months to sit down with more thought leaders regarding current affairs related to the world of APAC securities finance. I am Matt MacArthur in Hong Kong. Join us next time for Asia Securities Finance Monthly, wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is exclusively sponsored by Equiland, a global fintech firm for the securities finance industry.